U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Justice Stephen Breyer reportedly plans to retire from the Supreme Court as Virginia's new governor, Glenn Youngkin, gets in a brawl over masks at schools. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We're joined today by my colleagues, columnist Kim Strassel and editorial writer Kate Batchelder Odell. The big breaking news Wednesday is several outlets are reporting that Justice Stephen Breyer intends to retire from the Supreme Court. Kim, what do you make of this? It seems to me it's always a surprise when it happens, but this one at least I think was pretty well predicted at least before the summer.
A surprise, but not a surprise in that progressives really wanted him to give up this summer. And allow Joe Biden, or I should say last summer, and allow Joe Biden to have that fight right away in his term. And it was really notable that Breyer just refused to do so. And I could understand why, because honestly, there has been no time during his entire tenure on the court where he's been having a better moment. Think about this. He was confirmed in 1994, nominated by Bill Clinton. He spent more than 11 years as the court's most junior member, and then another 15 in the shadow in terms of seniority of John Paul Stevens and Ruth Bader Ginsburg. And only after Ginsburg passed away did he become the most senior liberal justice, which meant he's able to speak earlier and exert more influence in the private conferences that the justices have. It gave him the ability to assign the liberal wing's dissents. He's been kind of at the height of his power. And when he was asked last spring if he was going to cave to this dramatic, massive progressive pressure campaign to get him to go, he basically said, no, I'm going to stick around for a while. Now, that being said, it was always clear that, you know, often justices have some deference to the party of the president who appointed them, knowing that there are limited windows to give the next president of that party an opportunity to name a replacement. With the midterms coming up and the high likelihood that Republicans are going to take over the Senate, which would undermine the ability for Biden to get a nominee through, I can see simply out of good grace, Breyer doing this. It's probably really hard for him to do it, but he's a pretty honorable guy. He has a lot of, he's an institutionalist with a lot of love for the court, and this doesn't strike me as odd in that regard.
And that's why I think it was almost predictable that this would happen, at least before the summer. There was this pressure campaign on him. The slogan, Breyer Retire, went around, and then there was some suggestion that maybe that would backfire, that maybe that would cause him to dig in. There has also been the suggestion floating that he's finally the senior justice on the liberal side, and so he gets to assign opinions. There's some power that comes with that. Maybe he would want to spend some more years enjoying that. But Kate, Stephen Breyer is not a politically naive guy, and maybe if Democrats were expected to retain the Senate, he would be trying to hang on. But it looks, at least according to the current polling, that the Democrats are in for a shellacking in November, and Stephen Breyer wants to be replaced by a justice of a similar mold.
Right, Kyle. I mean, you have to remember that many progressives were unhappy that Ruth Bader Ginsburg didn't retire during Obama's tenure. Justice Breyer is 83 years old. There is no guarantee if he doesn't choose to retire when he would be replaced. And I think you're right that he's reading the tea leaves pretty well. I also think it is just an honorable decision to retire. It is becoming, I think, a little bit more common for justices to die in the court, as we've discussed. But I think this is an honorable decision for him to step down. But I do think it will be a contentious process trying to replace him before the midterm elections this fall.
So according to the reporting that we have as we tape this, he is expected not to formally retire until the end of this term. So it won't have any effect on the cases that the justices are hearing and deciding right now. But Kim, how do you think that his replacement on the court would have an effect on the court's jurisprudence?
Well, let's remember what we're talking about in terms of a replacement. Joe Biden promised on the campaign trail that he would nominate a Black woman to the court. Presumably, he will stick to that. We can go through some of the possible people who are out there as names. One of them is California Supreme Court Justice Leandra Kruger. There's a U.S. District Court judge named Ketanji Brown Jackson, who happens to have been a Breyer clerk. there's U.S. District Court Judge J. Michelle Childs, who is heavily favored by Congressman James Clyburn of South Carolina, who is a very close ally of Biden's. So those are just some of the names. But here's my general view, is that whoever gets named is likely to be a progressive firebrand, because that's been the kind of mantra of this White House, is keep progressives happy. And in that regard, I actually think that this nomination could do real damage to progressive causes in terms of Supreme Court rulings. And here's why. Breyer is very clever. He's very pragmatic. And if you've looked at him in recent years, his entire goal has been to try to land in a spot that he could pull over Chief Justice John Roberts, pull over a vote like Brett Kavanaugh, appeal to their sense of institutionalism, and move them away a little bit from the conservative majority. He's been pretty successful at that, but only because he's been willing to have those pragmatic points of view. That is not something you see from Justice Kagan or for Justice Sotomayor. And to the extent you're likely to get another jurist in the mold of those two women, just simply because of the progressive demands here, I think that you're going to find that they're going to be, that block will be much more aggressive in its positions and make it that much easier for the conservatives on the court to go their own direction.
The other thing I think Breyer is notable, at least lately, when we're talking about those progressive demands, is he has pushed back against a lot of them. And here's a couple quotes of him from the CNN write-up. He says, "It is wrong to think of the court as another political institution. It is doubly wrong to think of its members as junior league politicians. If the public sees judges as politicians in robes, its confidence in the courts and in the rule of law itself can only diminish, diminishing the court's power, including its power to act as a check on the other branches," unquote. And so there's an example, Kate, of where I think he has done a lot of good being somebody on the other side of the bench, as it were, from his conservative colleagues, and yet who's making the case, or has been at least in the past couple of years, against all of this talk about adding justices court packing.
Yeah, Kyle, I don't think that the court packing is a very popular proposition. It does not tend to poll well. I think people, even though the current number of justices is not enshrined in the Constitution, I think people understand what voters understand what Democrats and progressives are trying to do when they talk about packing the court, which is generally get an outcome they like. I think Kim's point is very salient about the way that a hardcore progressive nominee could backfire for Democrats here, especially given, as we've discussed, how important collegiality and relationship building are, how important those are to the court's functioning and how much influence they have on where majorities come out. So I do think that will be something to watch. And it's not a moment that fundamentally alters the character of the court in the way that some of the previous nominations have, but it may do so in more subtle ways like the ones Kim's describing.
So, Kim, what's the advantage of announcing this now, or leaking it now, rather than waiting till the term is over? That's what recent justices who've retired have done. So Justice Anthony Kennedy, for example, announced it in June. And here we are in January. What's the story there?
Yeah, it is a little bit surprising. And you have to wonder if there's a little politics at play here, because before this Justice Breyer news came along, what was the dominant headline? It was all about how everything is awful for the White House. And one benefit of this, whether or not it was for that reason or not, and maybe Justice Breyer will speak to this in days ahead, or somebody will leak something, but an obvious benefit is that this is an opportunity for the president to have a new issue, to say, look, you know, here's the power of the presidency. Here's why it's important that we won. Get a nominee out there that really excites the base. And now, I mean, you could have done that as well in the spring, but it certainly is an opportunity for the White House to at least change topics.
The timeline, I think, is also important to consider, given that Republicans look like they have a reasonable shot of taking the Senate in the November elections, which only gives the Democrats a majority through next January, January 2023, to confirm a successor. And that is a decent cushion. It seems to me if Justice Breyer had retired in June, you have 6 months to get somebody appointed under President Biden. On the other hand, Kate, there are a lot of examples of hangups and things that can go wrong in history, justices who don't get the majority for one reason or another, and then it would put President Biden in a really tough spot. So it seems like this gives him a little bit more room to maneuver.
Yeah, I mean, remember now that Supreme Court justices can be confirmed with 51 votes. Harry Reid started that precedent for appellate nominees, and Majority Leader McConnell finished it with Neil Gorsuch during the Trump administration. And so you don't need 60 votes, but Democrats have been having difficulty coming up with 51 votes lately on, for instance, some of their signature spending projects. So I do think there's not a lot of margin for error in the legislative calendar between now and November, given how much time Congress spends. We'll spend in recess, we'll spend back in the district doing work. It will be a relatively condensed timeline. And as we've seen with other nominations, if a nominee stumbles in committee hearings, which can be brutal, you might not have time to restart the process with someone else. So the pick is going to be a really important for them to land this.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from The Wall Street Journal.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at AlibabaPowersBusinesses.com.
From the opinion pages of The Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. On Inauguration Day in Virginia earlier this month, Glenn Youngkin signed an executive order to overrule universal mask mandates in schools, giving parents essentially an opt-out. At least 7 school districts have now sued to stop the order. Some are sending students who show up without masks to wait out the day in the gym or the library. And here's Governor Youngkin on Monday speaking on the John Fredericks radio show.
What I'm telling parents today is trust the legal process. It's not happening as fast as I would like. We've asked for the Supreme Court to expedite things this week. We'll see how that goes. Trust the legal process. Love your neighbor. This is one of these moments where I know people might want to do some things that make a strong statement. I just love your neighbor. That's day number one.
Kim, what do you make of this latest dust up? It reminds me a little bit of what happened in Florida last year, and tensions on both sides high, but it's hard to go wrong when you are putting forth the message, love your neighbor, I think.
Right. Good on Youngkin for having that approach. He's not encouraging civil disobedience. He's not encouraging higher tensions. He's saying, look, I've put out a new executive order. There's a real legal tension here. We have to let the courts sort it out. And there really is a legal tension. This is not as simple as we just don't like this and therefore don't want to comply. There is a state law which certain school districts are citing in their legal challenges. And in particular, you've got the school districts of Fairfax and Prince George and some in the Richmond area suing over this. And they point to a state law that says that they are supposedly required to follow federal guidelines. And that is in conflict with a duly issued executive order from the governor, which is itself rooted in state law. In particular, a law that outlines a very broad right of parents. In the Code of Virginia, it quotes that a parent has a fundamental right to make decisions concerning the upbringing, education, and care of the parent's child, end quote. That is what he is basing his authority on. So we'll see how this goes going forward. His memo outlining this also made some compelling points for the court about how there is really no evidence of efficacy of masks working, and pointing out that the prior orders that were in existence under the previous governor, Ralph Northam, were actually outdated and that they were dealing with a different version of the COVID virus. So we'll see where this comes out in the courts. But for now, he's got the right approach.
But part of what's going on here, it seems to me, is a real cultural divide. In some places, particularly rural places, people generally don't want masks. And in some places, cities, suburban areas, people are very supportive of masks. There's an August poll by Monmouth of Virginia. It says about 2/3 of registered voters, 67%, and parents specifically, 64%, support the requirement that students, teachers, and staff in Virginia schools wear face masks this year, unquote. And that's an old poll, of course, that's from August, so who knows what it looks like now. On the other hand, the Omicron variant is still kind of fading in Virginia, And I also think that poll hides probably some enormous geographic differences. In rural areas, support for masks by parents is probably closer to 10%, if that even. And in cities, suburbs, Fairfax County say, maybe it's closer to 70 or 75%. And so, Kate, why is the best principle here not that of subsidiarity and push these decisions down, make them not at the state level for a state that is as varied as Virginia, make them at the lowest level possible?
Well, Kyle, I think Kim has done an excellent job laying out the genuine legal tension that exists here, and that I agree with your point that we should generally be skeptical anytime the state does intervene in what are generally considered local matters, though there is a genuine legal dispute that Kim was describing here about whether he is really taking over the school board authority or if he is merely allowing an option to opt out. But on your point about public opinion, I do think there are major geographic disparities. I would also note that Monmouth poll didn't break out, for instance, whether you support high schoolers wearing masks versus kindergartners wearing masks, which is a different question, both on how efficacious the masks are and because mostly of who can keep them on and for how long and how much compliance there is, for instance. So there are different considerations there across the spectrum on who wears masks. And the law that the school boards are invoking says that the schools need to follow CDC guidelines to the maximum extent practicable. So there are practicable questions, especially for young children in particular. I also note, Kyle, it is, I think, disappointing that so many school districts are not making good faith efforts to try to comply with this while the legal process plays out. The Washington Post has a story up about some of the disputes that were going on at schools. And, you know, there's a 10-year-old kid named Noah Rafalski who he teams up with a friend to enter school without a mask because he's nervous. He gets put in a auditorium for the day. They call his mom and ask him to pick him up because he's not wearing a mask. And I think that use of children in this dispute reveals a real lack of good faith on complying and getting this sorted out through the legal process.
But I think what I'm trying to suggest is it seems to me that on the right, it is underrated how much of these policies are driven by parent and family demand. And I don't have a great theory, overarching theory, for when it makes sense for a central government or a governor in a state to override the principle of subsidiarity. One possible answer would be, Kim, is if these COVID policies were broadly opposed by the parents in these counties and were being kept in place because of demand by staff, teachers, unions, administrators, entrenched interests that were not serving the demands of the students and the parents. But in a lot of these counties, Fairfax County, the people who are suing the governor over the mandate, Kim, it seems to me that this is what the parents want.
So I would argue, Kyle, that the principle of subsidiarity should be overruled when there is very strong evidence that schools are ignoring real-world evidence out there that conflicts with guidelines, and also in which they are imposing rules and mandates that are detrimental to the health and upbringing of the children who are having to attend those schools. I mean, Kate touched on this very well. There is really no evidence whatsoever that wearing masks is in any way stopping or halting or impeding the spread of coronavirus. There is tons of evidence growing by the day that there is notable harm inflicted on kids that have to exist under these mask mandates, especially younger children. Masks inhibit their ability to communicate. We know it's delaying language development. We know that it's impeding emotional and social skills, feeding into feelings of isolation, new mental health issues. All of this has become a major concern over the last couple of years. And so I do think that in situations like that, that there is some real sound evidence for why the governor should intervene to stand up under state law, which he has cited, for parents that are deeply concerned about the health and welfare of their children and do not want to be subject to these ongoing mask mandates, especially when they have very little evidence of efficacy.
Well, to that point, I mean, I will say that I find the bluntness of the mandates, even at the local level, a little bit strange at this point in the pandemic. And the defenders will say, go look at the Centers for Disease Control page in Virginia. The Omicron spike is dropping, but it's not quite halfway down from the peak. The moving average now is 12,000 new cases a day. And of course, they're more mild cases, in part because that's what Omicron does, in part because more people are vaccinated. So the daily deaths are 10% of what they were last year. But on the other hand, it's notable that the places where they seem to want these mandates are also the places where vaccinations appear to be the highest. And the Virginia Department of Health has a nice landing page. You can get all sorts of data. So I went and looked at Fairfax County this morning, and percent of population vaccinated at least one dose by age group. Kids 12 to 15, it's 91%. Kids 16 and 17, it's 96%. So Kate, to begin with, this was a group that was at extremely low risk of an adverse outcome from COVID. And then 96% of the 16 and 17 year olds, despite that, are already fully vaccinated. And so a policy that applies to them and doesn't include any opt-outs for people who are vaccinated doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense anymore.
Right, Kyle. I mean, I think that's exactly right. You are seeing the demand for these policies places where the risk factors are lowest. And I think that reflects society's sort of broader confusion about COVID that's been sowed over the past year, and maybe an argument why you do want an energetic executive using the full extent of his authority to make changes here that are rooted in all the considerations you have to consider when you make political decisions, including the cost to children as well as the benefits. So I think that is an argument for what Youngkin is trying to do here, though I agree there's some genuine legal issues. And it's important to remember, Governor Youngkin was elected by many suburban moms who wanted him to stop the chaos in school. So I think it's appropriate for him to start his tenure by looking at what is legally possible for him to do to make changes. Because the only thing I would add to Kim's point about there are cases and when subsidiarity is worth overruling is that there is a really urgent cost, generational cost going on to children, and the dysfunction going on in public schools is extremely urgent. And allowing this status quo to continue indefinitely, and it is indefinite, we don't have any idea when these restrictions might be able to be lifted under CDC's recommendation, there are huge costs of that strategy. So I think you have to think about that when you weigh what Youngkin's doing.
One last thought on the mask mandate issue is Youngkin is also saying that this ban on mandates, or the parent opt-out, however you want to look at it, also applies to private schools. And what do you make of that, Kim? I mean, these are schools who, first of all, they set their own rules, their own dress codes. Second of all, some of them involve religious instruction. And third of all, don't forget the parents are paying to be there and chose those schools in the first place. And in my view, are treated more like customers and the people being served than is the case often at public schools.
Yeah, I saw a little piece that was interesting on Cato on this, and obviously a very libertarian group that was arguing against this, saying private schools should have their own set of rules. And I appreciate your point about how parents are paying to be there. But that being said, that doesn't, again, necessarily mean that just because you paid to be there and just because you're in the private system, that somehow, again, those parental rights or worries about their concerns for the health of their children go away. So there's really two choice elements here, right? There's the choice of a school by parents, which might have been made long ago when they first signed their kids up for school. And then that administration may still be now imposing a mask mandate, which conflicts with, again, the individual choice of parents who are worried about the health of their kids. I just also think it would be a bit odd for the governor to have a two different system environment going on in the state, where this argument that he's making that parents should have a say in the health and welfare of their children stops at the door of private schools. And so I kind of get the point, but I don't think it's entirely well thought through. And if he were to have that two different system approach, I think it would actually undermine his own legal arguments in court.
Thank you, Kim and Kate. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. We'll be back tomorrow with another edition of Potomac Watch.
U.S. businesses thrive on Alibaba's online marketplace, where sales by American companies to Chinese consumers added $53 billion to the U.S. economy in 2022. Discover more at alibabapowersbusinesses.com.